Hi, welcome to Motorcycle Views with me, Dave Marsden, here on Fab Radio International, brought to you by Z-Power, Kawasaki parts specialist. This show is all about news, views, information and anything else going on in the motorcycle world. We'll have guests, tips, travelling advice and reviews on anything motorcycle related. You can email us at motorcycleviews@yahoo.com. I'm joined also by my wonderful producer, Michelle. So let's get on with the show.
Well, show six already. And we're still under lockdown. But with a little ingenuity, a little technology and perseverance, we do at least have a show. On this week's show, we have part two of our interview with Kawasaki Triples expert Malcolm Anderson. We've got a road test on the new Suzuki Katana 1000, a chat with a Ducati dealer, and some more questions and answers. Oh, by the way, most of this was done before the lockdown. Not much news to talk about, what with the C word, but we do have the UK's bike sales for March, down 22%, which is a surprise. I thought it'd be down more like 75%. But then the lockdown didn't start until mid-month, and it was the beginning of the new registration season, so we must have had a few good weeks before the lockdown. April should be horrendous. Anyway, the biggest selling two-wheeler was Honda's PCX125, of course, the scooter. They sold 317 of them. Biggest selling big bike as such is the BMW R1250 GS. No surprise there, 272 they sold in the 2 weeks before the lockdown. Now, Kawasaki must be happy. They think this is the first time in the custom category the Kawasaki Vulcan 650 sold 67 of them. I think that's the first time they've been in there. Naked bikes, Royal Enfield Interceptor 650, 161 sold, that's good. Sports Tourer bike, again, good news for Kawasaki, the Ninja 1000 SX. They sold 197 of them, I think that's some sort of record as well. Super Sports, BMW S1000 RR, 206 of them. The touring bikes, BMW again, R1250 RT, 89 of them, doing quite well BMW. Biggest trial enduro bike was the Honda CRF 250 LA. 103 of them sold. Most of the dealers are still closed, of course. Some have opened their workshops for MOTs and a bit of servicing, but it is bad news. Z-Power, by the way, they're open for mail order and they're doing very, very well. Obviously, all you guys sat at home doing nothing, obviously finishing your bikes off, so well done. Oh, apparently, my guest last week, Spencer Robinson, he forgot to mention his sidecar partner. So a shout out for Colin Davis, aka Angus. Hope that gets you out of the doghouse, Spencer. So let's get on with this week's bike review. Hey, even though I'm a Kawasaki man at heart, I did own other makes of bikes over the years. Many other makes of bikes, actually. In fact, in the early 80s, I had a few Suzuki Katanas. I had a 1000cc one, the limited edition one, and the 1100 as well. So I was really keen to try out the new modern version that Suzuki have recently brought out. So I took myself down to Millennium Motorcycles in St. Helens, one of the Northwest premier multi-franchise dealerships, where sales executive Kev Parker gave me the keys to a new 2020 Katana 1000. So first, let's cover the tech section. It's a 999cc inline liquid-cooled 4 with a double overhead camshaft, producing 150 brake horsepower and 80 foot-pounds of torque. The bike is actually fitted with the older GSX R1000K5 motor, which is considered to be the best of the recent 1000cc models. It's got a 6-speed gearbox and a chain final drive. It's fuel injected, of course. Top speed is claimed to be around 160 miles an hour, and it weighs around 215 kilos. ABS is standard, of course. And there is three traction control settings, but no power modes, which is not a bad thing, really. 17-inch wheels front and rear, Brembo monoblock radial-mounted four-piston front brakes, and a standard-issue Nissan single-piston rear brake. KYB supply the front and rear adjustable suspension. Seat height is 825 millimetres,
and the fuel tank capacity is a measly 12 litres. It's got all-round LED lights, and it comes in a silver option, just like the 80s bike, and a solid black option. The clocks are only LCD. Yeah? A couple of years ago, we'd be screaming about that. So what does it go like? Well, like any of Suzuki's GSX 1000 models, it's got loads of power. It's got a smooth engine, and it's got quite a bit of low-down grunt. Not as much as you'd think, but yeah, it's enough. It's got an excellent gearbox, Suzuki are renowned for that, and it's got a medium to light clutch. I'd go to the medium, actually. It's not as light as some of the newer models. Now, Suzuki are renowned for their gearboxes, and this Katana is no exception. Unlike some big bikes, the Katana will go down to 30 miles an hour in top gear. I had it to less, actually, but we'll use 30 as a yardstick. It'll go down to 30 without any fuss, and then pull away all the way to whatever you can hold on to. Which is the problem, of course. Hardly any wind protection means that after the legal limit, you're subject to, let's say, quite a bit of wind buffeting. It's very stable. It's at normal speeds, yeah, it felt great in a straight line. And nothing seemed to alter its straight line course, although I did find it a bit bouncy once leaned over on anything but a smooth surface. Perhaps a little fettling on the suspension would cure this. I never touched it. Road hurdling, excellent. Perhaps due to the standard fitment of Dunlop Road Smart 2 tyres. And the steering felt nice and easy, although there wasn't much of a turning circle. My feet-up U-turn test nearly ended in disaster. The bars and footrest, well, they were perfect for me, and I'm 6'3", but the seat felt a little hard. But I don't suppose you'd be doing many miles on it. It was okay for the 20-odd miles I tested it, but I'm not sure what it'd be like on a couple of hundred miles. The bars did get a bit vibey at high revs, but to be honest, I don't mind that. And let's face it, I don't think you'll be doing much high-speed touring on a bike like this. Luggage space is not high on the list. I found the mirrors excellent, and the LCD clocks were, yeah, they were pretty easy to read, even in bright sunlight, which was a pleasant surprise after a few Hondas I'd ridden recently where in the sunlight you just couldn't see them. Although some of the information was a little too small. Well, it could be just me, of course, with my aging eyes. But the Katana Sword logo on the display is a really nice touch. The switch gear was great. Suzuki have really got it right with their left switch. Not too much in for one of them and easy to use, although it's a pretty basic bike anyway with not much going on. The 4-into-1 standard exhaust sounds good. Yeah, sounds good, especially after 3,000 revs per minute. I never tired of an inline 4 exhaust, no to high revs. I was brought up on them. The test bike was in the solid black colour, which, in my opinion, does the bike no favours. The classic silver is a much nicer option. Despite its weight, it feels surprisingly light and agile, unlike the original bike, which is a lump. And, you know, weaving between traffic was a doddle. It just felt good, you know. Riders will, of course, wonder why there's no power modes. And while 150 brake horsepower is quite powerful, I think the traction control in your right hand will be more than adequate. The Brembo front brakes were more than a match for the suspension and engine. Those Brembo calipers are excellent. They give progressive confidence-inspiring stopping, which means they're good. The rear brake was just the usual adequate thing that you just use for steadying you up, I guess. So what about the bad bits? Well, the side stand seemed a little short. I find that a lot now on bikes. It just worries me. Put it on the side stand, and if you're on a camber, it's whoa. And like I said before, some of the info on the clocks was a bit small to read. You might not find that problem. That vibration at high revs, the hard seat, the lack of any wind protection, but by far the worst thing is the 12-litre fuel tank. At an average of, say, well, let's say 45 miles to the gallon, you'd be looking for a fuel station every 110 miles. But then again, maybe this is okay for a bike of this nature. Will you be going big distances? I don't know. No centre stand, my pet hate, of course, but looking at it, I don't even think it's offered as an option. I don't even know where it'd fit. Now, Suzuki offer quite a few extras for the Katana, as you'd expect, including a taller screen, which I think it needs, heated grips, and a choice of, like, carbon engine covers. They also offer a Samurai pack. That's an extra £1,240, which gets you a fly screen, a coloured seat, a tank pad, carbon alternator cover, carbon clutch and starter cover, and a carbon front fender. and you get like a red four-piece decal set, and you get some like wheel rim decals. It sounds a lot. If you buy that, it saves you like £200 from buying them all separately. Price, by the way, is £11,400 retail, but I've already seen dealers offering them at, well, I saw one dealer offering them at over £2,200 discount on them, which is incredible, really. It makes it a good buy at that. Now, Suzuki are offering 0% finance on them at the moment as well, so if you could get that discount and that 0% finance, and then you'd be onto a winner. So should you buy one? At the discounted prices, they make sense, and they're almost a bargain. But I'd go and test ride a Kawasaki Z900 RS first before you decide. Thank you to Millennium Motorcycles for the loan of the bike.
This is Fab Radio International.
OK, so we're back with our interview with Malcolm Anderson, part two, this is. We spoke to him last week. So, Malk, I've got a few more questions for you.
No problem. It's good to see you again, Dave.
Good. OK. Right. Kawasaki triples. Three exhaust pipes, one for each cylinder. What about the Suzukis? What about the GT range? How do they compare?
Well, the Suzukis arrived later, so Kawasaki had really taken the cream off everything because of, you know, what they'd produced. And then Kawasaki were trying to simulate it. They even water-cooled their 750. But the bikes were heavy. They obviously put on the four pipes rather than the three, which we must assume was for aesthetics, so they thought it would look better, possibly trying to emulate the CB750 Honda and the Z1 Kawasaki 900, as they knew they were big sellers. And I think at that time, Kawasaki only did two strokes. So maybe they've seen the four pipes as a way to improve sales.
Yeah. Kawasaki only had the Z1 as a four-stroke, I guess, up until 1974, really. That's when they brought out the 400 twin, which was always a strange one, really. Kawasaki replaced a lot of the triples with twin-cylinder bikes. I mean, we had the Z400 instead of the S3, and we had the Z750 twin instead of the H2. I mean, how could you be so far away? I mean, somebody comes off an H2 triple and they're not going to want to buy a 750 twin, are they?
Definitely not. Have you even mentioned the name to Rick Brett that we talked about last week, who, of course, is the president of the Kawasaki Triples Club? He just cannot believe how we could go from a H2 to a Z750 twin, and they actually thought that would increase sales.
Yeah, incredible. I think they were thinking of the American market with the emissions and the unleaded petrol situation and the emissions for any bike in like California. So, and having said that, the Z400 twin was America's best-selling bike for a while, and unbelievably the Z750 twin was, but they were built there in America as well. That was when Kawasaki started building bikes over there, so that was to get around tax law, so that it made them cheaper. So I can see why there was a big seller over there. Funny enough, in 1977, the dealer I was working at, Not Mill Motorcycles in Manchester, we only sold three of those Z750 twins.
I was actually going to ask how many Z400s you sold at Not Mill.
Well, we sold a few of them only because we had a dispatch company around the corner called Gaskin Hawley, and they used them for as dispatch bikes, and that's the only ones we sold. But we used to replace them every 3 months, so we had a continuous supply. So, of course, our boss, Arthur Arnold, used to give them to us as company bikes, so I did quite a lot of miles on those 400 twins.
I lived in the Isle of Man during all my motorcycling youth, and the local Kawasaki dealer there certainly sold a lot of KH250s and KH400s, the smaller triples. But I spoke to him maybe 10 years ago, and he said he thinks he only sold one H2 and one early Z1.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Quite small figures.
Hello, but small island.
Yeah, on the strength of the amount of KE125s and KE175s he sold, he got a trip to Japan.
Really?
Yes.
It must have been a popular bike over there. I suppose if you're only, I mean, the island's, what, 50 miles?
Yeah, 50 miles by 25.
Yeah, so if you're going to work, I suppose a little 125 or 175 was more than enough.
Yeah, we had no moped law either, so one of my friends bought a Z400, brand new. He found it very slow, and after 8 weeks, he traded it in for a brand new Z900, still on L plates.
Oh, that's incredible. So, getting back to the triples, which is the rarest of the road bikes? I know the race bikes are rare. So, of the road bikes, what's the rarest of the range?
The rarest is actually the H1C, which was somewhat of a part spin special because it appears to be a H1B, the 72 model, And instead of having the disc brake on the front, it has the earlier H1A drum brake. And we always assumed the 2000 H1Cs that they made were possibly just to use up all the parts they had left.
Yeah, that would make sense. I mean, we've got customers with H1Cs. Turns out they're H1As at the end, but
yes.
And it's really difficult to tell. But then I've heard rumours that they came in orange, and we've got a customer who claims he bought one new and it was in red and a lot of blue ones. So what did they come in?
Everyone that we've come across in the States, because they weren't sold in the UK at all, they've always been orange.
Orange, same as an H1B?
Yes, identical colours to a H1B.
Okay, yeah, so it was obviously just a transition period between the A and the B.
Again, the other rare triple is a KH250. An A5, as it was termed, and this is basically a KH250 as we would know, but instead of having the disc brake on the front, it has the drum brake. And again, it looks like they were simply using up all the parts they'd overproduced.
What, from the S1C?
Yes, from the S1C.
In the 75 model, yeah, which is, again, came in that blue colour, which Kawasaki called halibut blue.
I mean, indeed.
Halibut blue, and why would you call a colour after a fish? In fact, have you ever seen a blue halibut? They had some strange ideas about colours in those days.
Again, the KH250 A5 was only imported into America and none at all imported into the UK. The first one I seen was probably around 1995, and it was a chap in Orkney, of all places, that owned it, Leslie Alexander.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Leslie's got quite a collection of bikes.
He has indeed.
So the A5 was a B1, KH250 B1, with just a drum front end?
With just a drum front end, it was. And as you said before, the rarest triples of all are the race bikes, the H1RA with 42 made, and the 73 H2R with 10 made, which are the two bikes I actually own myself.
They're still air-cooled models?
Yes, they're air-cooled.
Yeah, so the water-cooled ones came out, when was the water-cooled, about 75?
I would say possibly 74.
74?
Yeah, towards the end of 74, and then used extensively in 75. Again, produced in really small numbers. The H1R could actually be bought over-the-counter in the early 70s, although you really had to be somebody to get one.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the H2R was really a factory bike only to factory riders.
Strangely enough, in 1977, Kawasaki UK gave us a collection of race bikes to put in our showroom just to get showroom traffic in. And there was a 350 at the time, a 500 and a 750. And we had them for maybe 2 years. Kawasaki forgot all about them. We had to pester them to take them away. And now I'm kicking myself thinking we should have kept those bikes. They would be worth a fortune now. I don't even know who they were. They obviously were race, but by whom, I don't know.
Does Kawasaki UK have any sort of collection at the moment?
No, not really. They've bought the odd bike. I mean, they've got a Z1, which they use for various comparisons. When they brought out the new Z900 RS, we had a sudden influx at Z-Power of people, dealers, really, and Kawasaki Spain, Kawasaki Portugal, buying parts off us to restore a Z1, just so they could do a bit of advertising against the Z900 RS.
Yes, you can see that, where they'd want to put the old and the new together.
And then when Kawasaki brought out the Ninja H2, which is the supercharged thing, which is so fast, when I first heard the rumour of that, I got all excited. I thought, oh, a Ninja H2, it's going to be a 750 triple with a supercharger on it, and that would have been great. But it wasn't, of course.
No, it was a little bit of a disappointment, the H2, for me particularly. I had considered buying one, and I looked long and hard at it, and in the end I actually went on bought something else, which I'll probably mention later.
Yeah, well, I did buy one. In fact, it was in my front room for a long, long time. I never actually rode it. I just thought I'd buy it as an investment. But then I realised that maybe that wasn't a wise choice because the price of them was going down. But, you know, in 20 years' time, I'll be kicking myself, won't I?
It's hard to say, but you're correct. They've not been a good investment up to now.
No, but they never are. I mean, suppose a 1972 H2, after 6 months, was probably only worth half of what it was you bought. You paid for it, but, you know, who knows?
It would have been, and even in 1995 when I sold a H2A, that was probably one of the nicest bikes in the UK at the time, and that went for £2,750, and we considered that to be phenomenal money, and people are kind of saying, I can't believe you got that much for it.
I know. I remember getting £10,000 for a Z1 I'd built in 1995 after it had been on Top Gear with Steve Berry. And everyone was amazed, and there was talk all around the clubs. Dave Marsden's got £10,000 for a Z1. You know, I can't even buy them for that now, for a Zadona bike.
Yes, I'm afraid for £10,000 it would literally be in boxes, most of it missing.
Yeah, that's true. Do you think they're going to increase in value? Have we come to a standstill, or are they still going up?
The H2s in particular still seem to be slowly moving, I would say. For me, because the H2s have become expensive, similar to the Z1s, which have also, quite high-priced, you'll find that it's now pulled along the smaller triples. So it's the 250s, 400s that are actually moving up in value.
Yeah, we find that with most of the Kawasaki's. Like, people can't afford to buy a Z1, so they move to a Z1000, and then the value of those have gone up. So they've now moved down to, like, Z650s.
That's exactly what happens. I think the scene is as buoyant as ever. It's certainly a boom time scene. And now we're getting to the age where people are retiring, they're getting lump sums, getting the pensions, and they tend to look out and try to buy the bike that they could not afford in their youth.
Yeah, well, I say it all the time. 1975 is the big time for us in the Z1 world. There's 1975 Z1B. That's the most popular that people ask for. And when you work it backwards with the average age of the motorcyclist now, that was about time in 1975 when we were all about 18. So it was the bike we wanted, but we couldn't afford. So like you said, there are people in now getting a bit more money, and they're buying the bikes that they couldn't afford when they were kids.
Yeah, that's definitely right. And looking back again to my own youth in the Isle of Man, I actually only seen one H2, and that was actually being raced on Jerby Road Circuit, a H2C. And I only actually seen one Z1, and that was outside the Rendezvous Cafe in Douglas, which you may well remember from all those years ago.
Yes, I do indeed. So is the bubble going to burst, or is it just going to carry on? What's going to happen after we've gone, our generation? Is anybody going to be interested?
Who knows? It may slow down, but British bikes from the early part of the 1900 up to, say, 1930 are still selling, and all the owners are long gone. It's a difficult thing to surmise what will happen in the future. You get two views on it, where people will say, oh, the bikes are so rare, yes, they're going to be valuable, and others simply saying, yes, once we all die out, there's no one to buy them. But there's definitely people coming through into it. I had somebody age 40 had contacted me the other day to join the club, and they'd just bought a KH400. And my son himself, who's only 28, he loves riding the older bikes.
Yeah, that's strange, that. We had a customer come up to us at Stafford Show in October last year looking for parts for a KH250. And I thought, oh, he must be looking for parts for his dad. And the guy was 19, and he'd bought a KH250 because his father had told him about them. And he just got this urge to buy one, and he was keen. And I thought, wow, I mean, that's like, he was like the exception to the rule.
He's definitely the exception to the rule. And of course, one of the issues against it all is we were brought up in motorcycling. I know it was our way to go to work, but it also became our way of life.
It was.
And that's died away over the last, certainly, 15 to 20 years, where the youth of today simply don't have that experience.
Well, think about it. Our motorcycle test was driving around a block, and the examiner would go to each corner of that block and just check to make sure you're still riding, and the emergency stop was just pull up when you can. I mean, nowadays, these three-part tests and theories, they've made it very difficult to get into it. It's just easy to get your dad's car or your mum's car and just drive that rather than get a motorcycle. And as you said, it was a way of life for us at the time.
Most definitely it was. And even my son now has passed his test, my youngest boy, and he didn't start riding till he was 23. And it was quite strange. He's been saturated with bikes all his life, with me having them. And we were going off to the Manx Grand Prix, and he was coming on the back of me. And the next thing he says, oh, Dad, I've put in to do my theory, and I can't remember, what's the first part they do, Dave?
CBT.
CBT, that's it. He'd put in
compulsory basic training.
Yeah, and he went through, and I reckon it cost us £1,000 to get him through the test.
Yeah, I paid for my lad to do it many, many years ago, and it was about £700 for that direct access course. He's not ridden much since, really. He's got too busy with his family life, like most people do, and then you end up as born-again bikers. I hate that term, but that's what a lot of people are, isn't it?
I think you find that a lot of people have been out of it for 10 to 12 years. I've been very, very lucky. Even through marriage, three children, I've managed to hold on to at least one bike.
Oh, well, that's good. So you don't just collect these triples. You do actually ride them, I know that, but you've got other bikes as well. Well, other Kawasaki's, and you've got other makes, so you're not one of those diehard, I'm only going to buy a Kawasaki person, are you?
No, definitely not. Yes, I do ride. I mean, more so now I'm retired because life is a lot more relaxed, which you should be able to relate to as well.
Yeah,
well,
I don't know.
I ride locally when the weather's nice. I'm certainly not one for going out in the rain. I have around 10 different bikes insured for the road, and I'll attend the Triples rallies, do the Isle of Man, the Manx Grand Prix. It's a cheap holiday for me in the Isle of Man, as my 86-year-old mum still lives there. I've also rode out in the USA. I've been lucky to go out with Rick Brett 10 times or so to where he lives, and with his big collection of Triples, we've had a real choice. But as for my other bikes, I have a 72Z1, KZ900, the homologation special for World Superbikes, the ZXR750R, and of course an American Eagle, which was a very rare bike, a Kawasaki twin based on the 350 Avenger. And Jack McCormack, who had sold Triumphs, decided he was going to build an all-American product, and it was really what they would term today as badge engineering. He rebadged the Laverda Jota, and he literally did change just the badge on it, whereas with the Kawasaki, he actually changed the tank, the tailpiece, the side panel and oil tank. And the clocks themselves are identical to Kawasaki clocks, but say American Eagle rather than Kawasaki. Same with the side casings.
What year was that?
This would be 1968 and 1969 when he got involved with Kawasaki. The articles I've read was he tried to grow too quick too soon and basically ran out of finance.
Well, too quick too soon, I mean, hang on, there was hardly any of them bikes anyway, the A1 and the A7, the 250, 350 twin, there can't have been that many for sale in that, at that time anyway, so Kawasaki must have been keen to be giving him bikes that they could that he could rebadge.
That's definitely what it would sound like to me too. On the frame numbers we've got of the American Eagles produced, we've got around about a 500 differential. And we've come across maybe 12 worldwide.
12, that's not a lot, is
it? It's not a lot at all.
I mean, I've seen, I saw one many, many years ago. A friend of mine, Doug Perkins, had one. But to go to that much trouble to have the engine covers made and have the clocks refaced, I mean, that's quite a bit of an outlay, you know. It's not a cheap thing, but for the sale of what, 10, 12 bikes?
It's a lot of outlay, and the maximum sale would appear to be 500, and I don't think even that can be the case, because they're just not even coming up in the USA. Obviously, Rick Brett's watched out for them as well, because they've got a bit of a novelty to them. We've all been round a lot of salvage yards in the USA, and they're a very, very rare bike to come across.
Now, you've also got the forerunner of Kawasaki, Meguro. You've got one of their bikes, haven't you?
Yes, I have, a 250SG. This one's it's a little bit unusual in the fact that it's Meguro on the tank, but Kawasaki in the Speedo.
Oh.
So it must have been around the time when they were rebadging them.
Yeah, well, of course, they bought out Meguro, and then, of course, once they'd bought them out, they changed the name back to Kawasaki.
Yes, they did. But I read an article recently where they were looking to use the Meguro name. I reproduced the article in the last Kawasaki Triples magazine.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, well, there's a big thing in Japan at the moment with these retro bikes, the W800, and they do a 400, I think, and a 250. So, yeah, that would make sense, isn't it, to give it a Meguro name.
Yeah, definitely. And you can see that they'd want to live on a little bit of the heritage now. It's something they didn't seem particularly bothered about in the 70s. All bikes they sold from all manufacturers literally were a throwaway commodity.
Yeah, well, I suppose in the 70s that was their heritage. You know, they were just making their own heritage in the 70s. Like you said, it was a throwaway society, especially in Japan and in America. And of course, sales of second-hand bikes in America it just didn't happen. And that's why you drive down a main road in America on your bike, in the front yard, as they call it, of their house, there's always five cars going back from when they first started and maybe a few old Harleys, because they don't throw anything away. It's just stuck there in the garden. So you see these pictures of the scrap yards over there, and you just can't imagine that many bikes. I mean, it wouldn't happen in England, would it? I mean, bikes just got broken.
But no,
you see fields and fields and fields of 70s and 80s bikes.
And even now, the scrapyards that we went to 10, 11 years ago, there's not one Kawasaki Triple in them. And everyone's been cleared out.
Is that just those Europeans or are the Americans got in on the act now?
I think it's the Americans too, and you'll see these bikes hitting eBay. barn find, and you're thinking, barn find, it's in such a bad condition, it's just laying a salvage yard for years.
Yeah, well, that's, imagine that over in England, it'd be just be a pile of rusty oxidisation, wouldn't it? But some of them are okay. I've seen some of the imports. Obviously, we deal with customers who's bought these bikes over, and they're not bad considering they've been in the field for 30 years. You know, they're still usable.
Just depends on which part of the North America that they've come from. It's so much a different climate change over there. Yeah. Down in the south, obviously better weather, everything tends to be sun-faded and the seats split and bleached, whereas up north they do tend to be a little bit more corroded.
Yeah, but mainly the big salvage yards tend to be down south, obviously, for that reason.
They do. We went to one in Yale near Detroit, and obviously over the years the triples had parts removed, tanks, pipes, etc., and been sold, but the owner of the yard had now decided that every triple had value, so they had now all been shifted inside.
Ooh. Well, I suppose that's good news.
They were pretty ropey, to say the least.
Yeah, well, it's probably gone past the sell-by date by then, haven't they?
Very much so. And again, you can even notice with the imports coming back, it's got fewer and fewer now. Our Brexit problems haven't helped the exchange rate.
No.
And the bikes have simply got more expensive in America as they've caught on to the value of them.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, that brings us to the end of the interview, Malcolm. Just want to thank you for all your information, mind of information there.
It's been a pleasure to come, Dave, and if I can just give a last plug to the Kawasaki Triples Club. If you're going to get a triple, join the club.
Of course. Thanks, Mal.
Thank you.
Those hands are playing the strangest musical instrument in the world. The only instrument that is not touched. My hand. You ask for it.
Right, up next is a chat with Martin Bridgehouse. He's the top salesman at Manchester Ducati. Right, Martin, it's great to speak to you. Now, first question, how long have you been at Ducati Manchester?
Dev, good to see you. I've worked at Ducati Manchester for the past 9 years now.
Which is what? That's how long they've been here, isn't it?
We've been here 11 years. We started in 2009, and we were the world's first Ducati concept store, which was the retail plan that Ducati wanted. So it's a very boutique style of dealership.
So what was your background? What were you doing before?
Oh, from the age of 17, I'd started in the motor trade, started working with cars and did pretty much every job in a car dealership. Got a bit fed up with that. You know, people buy cars because they need one to get to work and function. People buy a bike because it's the passion, and they buy it with a heart. They don't buy a bike because they need one. I've always been a motorcyclist from a very young age. I started with trials riding and then progressed through. So bikes are where I'm at, and I can honestly say it doesn't feel like coming to work. I've loved and lived and breathed every second of the past 9 years.
Yeah, sounds just like me, that. I think we're all the same. Right, so what services do you offer here at Ducati Manchester?
So at Ducati Manchester, we offer a full range of new and pre-loved Ducatis. We also do sales and service work. We have a fully stocked clothing and accessories division. We try and sort of take it to the next level as well. We do quite well with the manufacturer. We win awards for Dealer of the Year and Sales Volume of the Year, and have done frequently over the past few years, which, you know, we're a small, tight-knit team here, so I'm proud of everybody that comes in. And I think it's fair to say as well that you sell someone a bike and they end up becoming a friend, and you'll be sending WhatsApp messages and all sorts of stuff. And I think one of the reasons that we are successful in what we do, we offer a Wednesday evening ride out, which is totally free of charge. As long as you've got two wheels, you can come along, you can meet everybody. You don't have to be on a Ducati. I think at the end of the night, after you've spoken to the owners and you've seen the passion and the love that they have with this brand, I think you'll probably end up wanting to own one. But we usually go for a ride round. We finish up in Holmfirth. I'm heavily involved with the owners club over in West Yorkshire. Me and a pal set that up back end of last year. So we meet up second Wednesday of the month in the centre of Holmfirth. And it's just great to get a load of Ducatis out. There's usually between 20 and 30 bikes there, ranging from early 70s machines up to the latest V4 superbike. So there really is something for everybody. It's a great community. It's great to see people getting involved. I can't tell you how many people call in, Dave, just for a coffee and a chat. Saturday's a busy Saturday here. It's like Old Trafford football ground. There's people everywhere, which is great to see. We know pretty much everybody by first name now, and vice versa. So I think we've got a real community hub going on at Ducati Manchester.
But don't you offer your ride out to Italy as well? And that's on one of the things you do.
Yeah, it's not a ride out to Italy. We take it to that next level, actually, Dave. We have the bikes shipped out to Italy the week before, and we send them the fully insured on a HGV and a crate. So it's lovely to fly out from Manchester on a Friday morning, meet your bike in the glorious Tuscan sunshine on a Friday afternoon. Now, there's usually, again, between 20 and 30 people on that. So we go watch the practice up at Mugello track on the Saturday. Sunday is race day. Monday we go up to Bologna, up the Fuuta Pass, which is where Ducati use, that's their test route from the factory. So the Fuuta Pass runs from Bologna down to Florence, and it's a cracking road, a bit like the Cat and Fiddle in places. We go up that, up to the Ducati factory. We do the museum tour, we do the production line tour. You get to meet the people who build these bikes, and they're assembled with passion and love, and it's a great experience.
Wow, that sounds amazing. So when you're at the race circuit, do you get into the Ducati grandstand?
We do, yeah. The tickets are for the Ducati grandstand, so you've got VIP parking. It's secure. They've got a security guard on there. They've got a cloakroom for all your stuff. You get yourself sat down on your seat, and then 10 minutes later they bring the riders out and you get a selfie opportunity. So it's a great place to watch the, in my opinion, the best MotoGP race of the calendar.
So do you do any local ride outs?
We do, yeah. We do ride outs, like I say, on a Wednesday evening, and we do them on an occasional Sunday. We're affiliated with the local branch of the IAM as well, so we believe that training's important. You know, if you buy a bike from us, we'll give you a pass to go and have a trial lesson with the IAM, and hopefully make you a little bit safer out there on the roads today. We also do a Scotland trip, so invariably it rains. I can't help that, unfortunately, hence why we offer Italy and or Scotland. Scotland's a great crack. We usually do about 1500 miles over 4 days. It's good fun. Ducati also offer their own insurance for the bikes as well. Insurance is a consideration these days. Things like the bike track tracker system are fitted as standard now on the majority of our models.
Okay, so what's new for Ducati in 2020?
Well, we're all really excited, Dave. We've got the new V4 Street Fighter due in store extremely soon. We're expecting our first demo by the end of March. Customer bikes who've already pre-ordered will be due sort of April onwards. So we've got a real buzz about V4 Street Fighter. The original Street Fighter has now got a massive cult following. It's really sought after. And the new V4 version promises to be everything that bike was, plus a whole lot more as well, with things like modern safety tech, etc., etc. We've also got the new V2 model coming out, which is 150 brake horse. It's already in store. We've got a demo available. You should try it, Dave. You'd love it.
I think I might hang on for that V4 Street Fighter. I really fancy one of them. So what's your top-selling model?
Well, we do really, really well with Multistrada in both 1260 and 950 variants. As you know, Dave, the adventure bike class is really where it's at the moment. Adventure bikes offer everything. You know, if you want to go out with your mates and do a bit of scratching, you can do that. If you want to pop a pillion on and ride to the south of France, you can do that in comfort. If you want to ride it to work in the Manchester winter, you can do that, and you'll be quite safe and refreshed when you get there. Great fun, 1260 or 950. The old saying, you pay your money, you take your choice, you decide.
So what about the Monster? I mean, when it came out in the 90s, it probably saved Ducati. Is it still a good seller?
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think the 797 range starts, and we can get people on a bike that's affordable and fun to ride. It's an air-cool bike. It's 75 brake horsepower. It's as light as a feather. You can throw it around. You can have some fun on it. So, yeah, the Monster range from 797 through 821 to 1200, we do extremely well with it, yeah. Good bike.
So, let's get on to the V4 models. Have they impacted the sales of the V-twin models at all?
We haven't seen that, Dave, no, because the V4 model in the V4 Panigale replaced the 1299 Panigale, which was the L-shaped twin. So we've not seen that. We've got a different demographic. We've got people trading in different sports bikes, different adventure bikes. We're taking a lot of BMW S1000RR, Yamaha R1M, ZX10R, GX1000s. And it's great to see these people, you know, being welcomed into the Ducati family with the V4S Panigale. It's such a great bike.
So the V4 models, they've brought you in a new influx of customers then?
Massively, yeah, and it's nice to see some new faces as well. And we've obviously got a real loyal customer base who've loved and cherished what we've done over the years with sports bike. And I'm sure you'll agree, when you look at the V4 Panigale, that single-sided swing arm, it's a real trademark of Ducati. You've got the underslung exhaust. They're just a piece of modern art, Dave. You could hang it up in the Tate Gallery and it wouldn't look out of place.
Now, I've spoken to other dealers. I mean, they all complain about the doom and gloom. Bikes are too expensive. But, I mean, the Ducatis are on the higher side of the motorcycle range. So, I mean, what sort of customers, what age group are you selling to?
Well, our average demographic at the moment is probably early 50s. We are seeing some younger blood with what we're doing with the track days that we offer and the Wednesday evenings and the social side of things. So it's nice to see. And to be fair as well, we're also getting a lot of ladies moving over to our brand as well, which is nice to see.
So, Martin, 2019 UK bike sales were just about OK. They were a bit up on 2018, but that was a pretty bad year anyway. So are you expecting greater things from Ducati in 2020?
Well, we're quite fortunate, Dave. All our hard work and effort pays off. And last year we won two awards for Dealer of the Year and Sales Volume of the Year again from Manchester. And I'm proud to say we've won those awards for the past 9 years now without fail. So I think it's fair to say that there's a good vibe in our showroom. If you come into our showroom, you'll meet people who genuinely own Ducatis. We live and breathe the brand. We ride. We know what they're like. You know, we can offer impartial advice on everything, and we really are passionate about what we do, and I think that does come across with our customer base, which is important. So to answer your question, I think this year with the new Street Fighter, with the new V2, is going to be a bumpy year, and hopefully, touch wood, we can, if all our customers remain loyal to us and keep supporting what we do, we can win the awards next year as well.
Okay, so you're big into the social media side of things as well here, aren't you?
That's right, Dave. Yeah, I think you've got to be these days. We're very active on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat. We do all that. We've got a brilliant website as well, which, again, wins awards. If you bring your bike in for a service, we do a video presentation of your bike with the technician, so he'll show you what he's doing, what parts he's replacing, if any, why he's replacing them, etc. And people really appreciate that video link. It gives them an insight to know that the bike's being looked after with a technician who knows what he's doing.
Well, as you probably know, Martin, my forte is old Kawasaki's classic bikes. And we found over the years that most of our customers are in the late 50s and early 60s. And they're not too IT savvy. So the internet has not really appealed to them. So we take a lot of phone calls. But are you saying that Ducati owners are a bit more up to date?
I wouldn't so much say that, Dave, to be fair. I think, you know, if we send you a video presentation of your bike, it comes on email and you also get a little link on your phone as a text message. So all you've got to do is press the button and you can watch your bike being serviced. So I think it's like anything. I think with modern technology, you just need to embrace it and take it for what it is.
That's great, Martin. Thanks for speaking to me today. It was a pleasure.
No problem, Dave, and it's a pleasure to meet the legend that is Dave Marsden.
Gosh, you're making me blush.
This is Fab Radio International. Embrace the alternative.
Okay, so this week we're having a Dave's Rant section, and helping me to rant today is our station manager, Paul, who was a one-time motorcyclist, still interested, of course. So what do you want to rant about, Paul?
Before I start ranting, I'd like to say thank you to you and the wonderful Michelle for doing... I always wanted a motorbike show, dedicated motorbike show here on Fab Radio, and you've achieved it, and I'm chuffed as a mint ball.
Oh, thank you very much.
So there we are. My rant is, well... I kind of revert back to when I was a kid. There's certain bikes I liked as a kid, and they were, in general, second-hand. They were affordable. So for me, in the 70s and 80s, even though I couldn't afford the posh ones like you had, the Z900s and all the rest of it, you could sort of get your head, generally speaking, around a second-hand bike, which was affordable. I always wanted you may laugh at me, a CD200. Because of the retro look of it, I know it's underpowered and it looks, you know, but I like the look of it. And they were like a working man's bike. And so it was affordable.
Well, I'm not going to laugh at you, Paul, because the bike's a bike. But let me just have a little chuckle to myself.
Okay.
A CD200.
Yeah, I did. It's just because, I mean, one of the greatest bikes, I think Steve Berry talks about it, one of the top 10 best bikes ever, was a C50.
Yes.
Yeah, and you can't argue with that because it got people to work. And back in the day, not everybody could afford this, that and the other. And so it makes sense to me that the working man as such, the blue-collar worker, could have a motorbike and still use it for going to work rather than nowadays travelling around the world or you know, being super, super, super amazing on this amazing bike with everything on it. Just a motorbike.
Paul, what's your point?
My point is the bikes, you can't afford them.
Well, yes. I mean, bikes are expensive. I mean, OK.
Why?
Because they are. Well, I always use the... I mean, £20,000 these days gets you a really good bike. It sounds a lot, £20,000.
It is a lot.
I know, you can buy a car. You can buy a good car for £20,000, so it doesn't make any sense. But the problem is with bikes is the mass production. I mean, a car, they must make thousands and thousands and thousands. And they probably sell thousands and thousands and thousands each week. But on bikes, you're talking maybe they only sell 100 bikes a week. So, of course, it's costing them much more to produce them, which has to be passed on to the customer, the retail customer. Of course, there's more to it than that, of course.
Can I jump in on that, yes. that yes. idea you got in your head? The reason why they're only selling 100 or 200 a week is because it's too expensive.
Yes, I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
If they're affordable, perhaps people will say, yes, let's save the planet, let's get a motorbike.
Well, some of them are still affordable. The bikes that are coming through from China.
Yeah, but they're rubbish.
Oh, see, you can't have everything. You can't have quality and cheapness. It doesn't go hand in hand. Everybody knows that.
Don't you think the markup on them is too high?
Possibly. No.
Nah.
No, no. In fact, as a dealer myself, I know on some big bikes, I mean, £18,000 bikes, some dealers are only making £400 profit. I mean, that's not much of a markup. I know the distributors, whoever the distributor in that particular country is, they might be making 15% on it. We know that because of the discounts they offer. And then, of course, the distributor in Europe is probably taking 15%. I'm talking about Japanese bikes here, of course.
Yeah.
But then you'll often find that a lot of the Japanese bikes aren't made in Japan. A lot of British bikes aren't made in Japan. Triumph make most of their bikes in Thailand. So it's very difficult to acknowledge how much they actually cost to make to start with.
So how can the sort of British motorcycle world continue? It'll always be fading then. If you're going down the road that you're talking about, expensive, and you told me, which I didn't know, that the average buyer of a motorbike is a 47-year-old.
Correct, yes.
Surely it should be looking at a 20-year-old, the 18-year-old, the 17-year-old.
Yes, but they're not interested in buying motorcycles.
Because they can't afford them.
Oh, yeah, I know, we keep getting that. But even if they were cheap, I mean, yes, there is quite a few. The biggest seller in the small market at the moment is a Chinese maker called Lexmoto, and they sell loads of little 50cc and 125. And they're about between £1,500 to £2,500. Would you consider that to be cheap?
I would consider that to be, for a new bike... A new bike,
yeah,
fairly cheap. I mean, it's okay.
Well,
so therefore, the second-hand version of that's going to be around about a year old, 700 quid, is it? 600 quid?
Perhaps a bit more. They don't appreciate. It's not like a car. They don't appreciate 50% overnight.
Okay.
But yeah, but it's finding. I mean, if you look at how many people have taken their 10-part test, whatever it is we're on these days,
you
find that's been slaughtered. You know, there's it's in just double figures and not treble figures. People taking their test to ride a motorcycle, so surely that's a reflection that they're just not interested in riding bikes because they're too expensive. But you know, they buy cheap cars and then pay what a 17-year-old on a Ford Fiesta, they might pay £500 for the car, but how much do they pay in insurance?
That's you're going to, you're frustrating me now, Dave. I love the show, however, you are frustrating me. You just said it then, a 17-year-old buying a 500 quid Corsa, and never mind the insurance side of it. 500 quid for a Corsa, which is mass-produced.
Yep.
And like the motorbikes are, although they're not selling as many. So if they sell loads like they sell the Corsa, back to my argument again, that it becomes more affordable.
Yeah, but how old would a £700 Corsa have to be? How old do you think it'll...
10 years old.
Well, I think you'd be lucky to get a Corsa for...
I reckon I can go to... I'll go online now and find you one.
Yeah, OK, well, the trouble with a motorcycle...
A 10-year-old motorbike, how much is that?
I know, that's what I was just going to say. A 10-year-old motorcycle becomes a classic, and then the price goes up. You can't win.
It's madness.
I know, it's crazy. It's just a situation that nobody would have thought 30 years ago that £300 on the CB200 was going to be worth now maybe £5,000.
Madness.
So if that's set in the bar, and then, of course, a new bike's got to be dearer than a used bike.
So what's the answer? What's the answer to people? And it's not just me. There's plenty of people like me who wouldn't mind. I know it's a weekend warrior thing, going back on a bike for the weekend and just enjoying the summer days, whereas I'm a bit too long in the tooth to be driving one every single day. But I might use one for work.
Really? I mean, do you want to turn up at work wet through, taking half an hour to get ready in the morning, half an hour to get out of your kit at night, and then run the risk of it being stolen when you go back down to the car park? That's reality.
That's reality, that's true. But it's I think motorbikes are a weird thing. Once they've got a grip of you, no matter how old you get or whatever, it stays with you, and you always are a little guy on a horse, an iron horse, going back home, even via Tesco.
Of course. I mean, every time on a motorcycle is an event. You can't really preach to me on that because I'm already the converted. The answer to it is, I think the other problem, of course, is that it's getting too technical. The bikes are now coming with so much electronic aids on them, which you don't really need. And, of course, that's pushing up the cost of the bikes. Most people are happy to just have what we would call a classic retro bike, as in the Royal Enfield Interceptor, which has just been released, and that's just £6,500. Just £6,500. Do you consider that to be expensive?
I consider that to be top of the... I mean, £6,000 for a bike, brand new, top of its range type world in my head. Well, that's about right, I suppose.
We're talking Royal Enfield.
Royal
Enfield.
I know.
So it's all... I mean, the trouble is with bikes is that they're not something you need. It's something you want. So whereupon you'll think about spending lots of money on a car because you don't really want it. It's just a necessity. On a bike, it's usually something you desperately need because you're a motorcyclist. So then you'll spend more money on them. And I think the manufacturers know that. And they're just taking advantage... You see, I've said it now. They're just taking advantage of us, aren't
they? So you go down my road,
then? I have. You've converted me, Paul, yeah.
Thank you, David.
Hi, it's Michelle here, and I'd just like to say I hope you're all keeping safe, not too bored, and you're all well in these very challenging times. Now, this week we have some more quick fire question and answers for Dave. These have been sent in to us over the last few weeks, so here goes, Dave. Right, do you like to wear earplugs?
Depends on whether I've got you on the back. Of course, with the intercom, earplugs are not really any good.
Clear visor or tint visor?
I like a clear visor, but I do like the dark tint inner glasses shield that you get in the modern helmets. Wonderful thing.
Noisy or quiet exhaust?
Well, it used to be noisy, but, you know, quiet. Quiet.
Have you ever scared on a motorbike?
Am I ever scared on a motor? Every time. That's part of it.
Most comfortable bike?
That BMW K1200LT Lux I had. I've had about five of them. Really, really comfortable.
Least comfortable bike?
That's got to be a Yamaha VMAX, the new 1700. It was just so angular. It just stuck into you everywhere you sat. Yeah, VMAX 1700.
Here's a really good one. Petrol or electric?
Petrol, of course. For now.
Have you always had a bike?
Yes, always.
Longest time between riding a bike?
2 weeks.
Best bike for taking a pillion on?
Well, I'd say the Undergoing, but you as a pillion, would you agree?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, definitely. Cruise control or not?
Yes. Sounds stupid on a motorbike, but yes, cruise control, I love it.
Carbs or fuel injection?
Fuel injection. Well, they're all fuel injected now, but yeah. But the problem with that is that you miss the smell of leaking petrol out of the carbs. But yeah, fuel injection.
Tube or tubeless tyres?
Tubeless. I can fix them in minutes. Tube tyres take hours.
Oddest place you've ever ridden to?
It's got to be Timbuktu. Yeah, Timbuktu.
wet or dry roads?
I don't mind, really. But dry, yeah, dry.
Riding on the left or right side?
Actually, I prefer riding on the right side. We do a lot of touring in America and other countries that drive on the right, and I've got used to it. So, yeah, right.
Most famous racer you've met?
Barry Sheen.
Rider or pillion?
A rider. You've no chance of getting me on a pillion.
Mirrors or no mirrors?
Mirrors. I love them. I love them.
Can you do wheelies?
Only when I don't mean to.
Most miles out of a back tyre?
Probably about 9,000 on a Kawasaki Verse E650. I was amazed I got so many miles out of it.
Least miles out of a back tyre?
Oh, I know that one. 1,800 miles on a Kawasaki ZX12R. Expensive or what?
Have you ever owned a British bike?
No. Well, yes. I had a Norton 961. That was British. And I had 5 Triumphs. Although I doubt if their Triumphs were actually made in the UK. So, yes and no.
Favourite helmet?
That'd be the one I'm using now. Schubert C4.
First race meeting?
Oh. Alton Park, 1976. It was a transatlantic trophies. Steve Baker, the guy, American guy with the glasses, he was the star of the show, I think, at that time.
Night or day riding?
I used to love riding at night, but day. My eyesight's got pretty bad at nights now. Yeah, day.
Valentino or Marquez?
Valentino, number 46.
When did you start in the motorcycle trade?
Ooh, that'd be September 1977 at Knott Mill Kawasaki in Manchester.
Greatest racer of all time?
All time, I'd say Barry Sheen. Everyone will disagree with me, of course. Recently, it's got to be Rossi.
Furthest country you've ridden?
What, ridden to or ridden in?
Ridden in, sorry.
Oh, New Zealand. Hang on, is that the furthest? Yeah, yeah, New Zealand.
Best bike movie?
Mad Max, of course.
Best bike song?
Motorbiking by Chris Spedding. Motorbiking, great song.
Best biker chick? Obviously me.
You first, second. Marianne Faithfull and Girl on a Motorbike.
Best bike magazine?
Well, it's a newspaper, really, but it's got to be Motorcycle News. I've been buying it since 1974 every week.
What was your first magazine article?
Oh, that was in 1983 in Mechanics magazine. They did an article on me on my Z1100R.
First TV appearance?
I did actually a few shows, TV shows, when I was at school, but we won't count them because it was not about me, but I think it was that Granada Report thing we did in 1995 when they did an article on us on selling bikes to Japan. They thought it was like selling fridges to Eskimos and coals to Newcastle. So, yeah, Granada Reports.
Most famous TV appearance?
Ooh, that's an odd one. We were on Sky TV. We did that video for the British government. Well, the one that everybody remembers is Top Gear in 1995, yeah, with Steve Berry. Steve Berry does his show here, of course, so, yeah, Top Gear.
Most surprising bike?
The most surprising bike, funny enough, I took out one of those Royal Enfield 650 Interceptor twins. I was absolutely amazed by it, so, yeah, yeah.
Most disappointing bike?
I think the most disappointing bike was that first BMW R1200 GS I bought, and the switch gear fell off before we got home. Yeah, we'll go for that one.
Bike you've done the most miles on?
That was that DL V-Strom Suzuki I had, which I went around the world on. 88,000 miles I did on that.
The bike you've done least miles on?
Oh, I know. That Buell CR1135. I did 3 miles on it and sold it.
Last question. What bike do you think you're going to buy next?
Always a difficult one with me, that. Whatever takes me fancy. I've got an inkling for one of those new Ducati V4 Street Fighters. I really like the looks of them. It might be me last chance at going fast.
Right, well, that's it. I hope I've covered all the emails that came in, and keep sending them through.
So if you do have any more questions, don't forget to send them in to us, either on our Facebook page or at motorcycleviews@yahoo.com.
So, this is the end of the show. You've been listening to Dave Marsden on Fab Radio International on Motorcycle Views. Join us next time for more motorcycle madness. Don't forget to send in your questions and listen to our podcast. Stay safe. Coming up next is The Ripman Show with Paul Ripley. He'll be playing music from 1969 to 1979.